All right. I am Jim Klein. I'm the Director of Technology at Saga School District here in California. How many of you folks are from California? All right. So we got a few. Where are you from, just out of curiosity?
Orlando.
Orlando. Wow. So you came a long way. Good. And she's from Cincinnati, I heard. Where are you from California?
No.
Where are you from?
Tampa, Florida.
Tampa, Florida. Wow. Cool. So I guess that...
we had to have an excuse to come across the country.
That's great. I guess that Florida-California connection thing really worked out, too. It is, yeah. Yeah. Well, you get off the plane in Florida and you hit like this wall of humidity. You know, it's like, it doesn't happen in California, which is kind of nice, actually. Of course, we've been cool the last few days, so that's kind of a surprise. But anyway, I am from California, obviously. I'm from Santa Clarita. For those of you from California, that's just up, well, it's actually south of here, just north of L.A., if you've ever been to Magic Mountain out there, my office is literally right across the street. And the funny, I'll tell you a funny story. When I started there about 13 years ago now, I thought, well, Magic Mountain is right there, Six Flags. I mean, I'm going to go there all the time. So I went over and I bought myself an annual pass. I don't think I actually used that pass once. It's just, you know, you just don't have time. Hey, man, how's it going? How you been? Haven't seen you in a long time. I'll talk to you later in the conference. That'd be great. we are elementary school district, K-6. We have about 11,000 students, 2,000 staff. We have 15 school sites. They're a pretty good size for an elementary school district. And we've been doing open technologies for some time. And one of the other things I am is I am the chair of COSIN's K-12 Open Technologies Initiative. How many of you are familiar with COSIN? A few of you? Okay. COSIN is the Consortium of School Networking Professionals. Basically, it's an organization for CTO types at school districts. It's a national organization. And we have an initiative where we're trying to promote, not necessarily promote, but at least provide good information for school districts who are interested in implementing open technologies. This is the website. We are hosting it. It has a bunch of great resources about what they are and those sorts of things, which are good for you as a tech person at your school district, because when you start talking about open technologies, often you have administrators asking, well, what is that? What does that mean? Those sorts of things. And there's a lot of great resources, things like, you know, the top five questions to ask your IT guy about open technologies and those sorts of things. So check that out, definitely. Also, this is my blog. I'm going to be posting, and I've actually already have posted the handouts, as it were, of this session on my blog, okay? So, and that's on my card up here, so don't worry about writing that down. Just come grab a card. My URL is on the back and go straight to my blog. You can pull down the documentation. All right, so I've heard that all great technology presentations start with a video, an inspirational video, so I thought I'd start mine with one as well.
Software. It's not about
commercial versus not commercial.
It's about free versus.
We learned that kids are really a lot smarter than.
As long as it like creates a little bit of a spark.
We have a common platform for anybody to experience.
That's all that matters.
Inventiveness and innovation are rising as they should. The dam has burst.
So I really love that video. One of the things I like the most about that video is the way that it evolves. It evolves from the you are here to the we are here, right? Because that's really the way our society has gone. It is no longer just about what I can do, it's more about what we can do together. And that's the way we work in education, and that's the way software is going, right? Really, if you think about it, the world's gotten a lot smaller. Right? I mean, it's gotten significantly smaller. We are able to hyper-connect to anybody instantly across the globe and work together and build and grow. And I think that's important. But also one of the things I like about that video is the education emphasis. You notice that there was a lot of emphasis on education. That was not a video that was produced by an educational institution. That was actually made by Red Hat, a company that does open source. Right? But education is a key player in the development of open source and the growth of open source and the growth of our economies really globally. One of the things I liked about that is the picture of the kids with the OLPCs. How many of you have seen an OLPC or had a chance to get your hands on one? And the great machines, I'm a huge supporter of those. They're about 500,000, as I recall, the last numbers were shipped to third world countries. These are some kids, I believe, in Singapore that are using them. Right? They're all powered by open source, and because they're powered by open source, they're not restricted by the licensing fees that you would have, all of the restrictions that we typically are used to in the United States. You can distribute them widely, distribute the software widely. You can actually download the software for this device and install it on one of your devices and play with it and see how it works. It was developed completely in the open. Right? Even the hardware was developed completely in the open, which is fantastic because you got the best minds involved in it. It wasn't someone trying to sell something or someone trying to keep it to themselves. It's really the evolution of science. We're back to what science used to be. Science used to be about publishing your work and sharing and working off of other people's work and those sorts of things. And science lately has gotten to the point where scientists are restricted by the corporations. They can't share their work. They can't publish it because everybody's worried about how they're going to make a buck. I also like the way that that involves or evolves into the United States. This is my daughter. Isn't she cute? And she's using an Asus EPC, which I have one of here if you'd like to play with one. EPCs are powered generally by Linux. Okay, and because they are powered by Linux, they are less expensive than a typical laptop. These machines cost about $300. Okay, you can get them into the hands of a kid and give them Firefox and OpenOffice and all the things that they need to have in the classroom for $300. That's about half the cost of a typical desktop PC. So when we start thinking about how we're going to get more technology into the hands of kids, why would we want to buy any more desktop PCs? We can get two of these for the price of one. Pretty fantastic. Our district is going to be deploying 1,700 of these to fourth graders in the next year. We're going to see how it goes. Got a big project around it. It's on the ETT grant. Trust me, we're going to measure it, keep track of it on my blog. I'm going to post all kinds of stuff like that. We've got all kinds of analysis and things like that. Lots of research has gone into it. All right, but when we think about all of these things, you see all of this open source. You see all over the world everybody's connecting. You see everybody starting to develop software with open source. Companies are going open source. You're starting to see more and more released. You have to come to the conclusion that really open source and open technologies are going to be driving innovation in the future, driving computing technology. Right? I'm not the only one that thinks that. Gartner says by 2011, 80% of all commercial applications will contain significant open source code. That's 80% by 2011. That's just 2 years from now. That's how fast this is evolving. That's how fast it's moving. And it makes sense if you think about it. If you can have 1,000 developers all working on a project rather than 5 or 6, things evolve much more rapidly. All right. So we talked about this stuff. Let's talk a little bit about what open technologies are. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I think we're all pretty savvy here, I hope, and we know what open technologies are. But basically, open technologies are divided into three categories, and the first one is open standards. Okay, well, an open standard essentially is just a clearly defined, publicly distributed protocol and process. We use these every single day. We don't even realize it often that we use these every single day. Now, I'm going to test your technology knowledge here. Remember, I geared this for teachers, so for those of you who know this stuff, you know, don't roll your eyes at me. Okay. But I'm going to test your technology knowledge of open standards. Okay, how many of you have seen that one? Of course. Everybody uses that one. We use that one every day. It's completely transparent. The reason we can use the browsers like Firefox and Safari and Internet Explorer, we can use anything we want to browse websites, even the new Google Chrome, is because HTTP is an open standard. It's publicly published so that developers can actually see how this thing works. right? They can write software around this technology so that you can use a web browser on your cell phone or anywhere and always expect to get the same results. Okay, so everybody knows this one. It's completely transparent, and that's an open standard we all use, right? What about RSS? How many of you use RSS? All right. RSS is really simple syndication, a few less people there. This is basically a way that you can subscribe to feeds, and the feeds being something like a news feed. So, for example, you go to a website for the New York Times, you'll see a feed on there, or an RSS marker in the top of your browser that tells you that this is a feed. If you click on that, you'll get a listing of all the articles that are on that site. And that feed will update automatically, so you can basically get prompted when there's an update to that location or that site. Most browsers support RSS feed readers. There's also a lot of other great ways you can use RSS, and I'm going to show you some of those later on in the presentation. Okay, what about iCalendar? How many of you use iCalendar? And I'm not talking about iCal, I'm talking about iCalendar. All right, iCalendar is a little different. iCalendar is essentially a way to share calendars. It's a standard open way to share events and basically schedules between applications. And you can use that to link applications together and to do some really neat things. All right, so those are open standards. Pretty simple. Everybody gets that? I don't think there's any questions on that. All right, so the next one, obviously, is open source software. Open source software is the most widely known open technology, obviously. And I really want to, it does all of these things, but I want to focus on two things. The first one I want to focus on is the freedom access or aspect. Most people think of open source software as free. It's free, it's free, it's free as in beer. You know, it's just free. But really what open source is all about is freedom. It's the ability to do what you want with this technology, with this code, right? You get the source code with it, so you're free to modify it and do whatever you want with it. The licenses are very unrestrictive, so they allow you to distribute this code or distribute these programs as widely as you want. And that's a big thing for school districts, right? If you think about it, one of our greatest restrictions is licenses. If we want to install software on individual workstations, we have to pay a per workstation cost to do that, and that has a huge restriction on how much technology we even try. Because if you think about how you plan your technology deployments with software, for example, the first thing you say to yourself is, okay, we want to deploy this software, how am I going to pay for it? Right? I've got to have a committee together, we've got to decide if we even want this software, because you've got to make a significant investment in it. If you were free from that, you have the ability to really try new things and to do something different in your classroom. So freedom is very important, but the most important thing about open source is community. Open source software is community driven, okay, and that's totally different from the traditional software model. You are actually involved in the process of the development of this software, okay, and this is very important, and you should get involved in the community if you're doing open source. One of the nice things about the community in open source is that they have a tendency to drive the way the software is developed. So, for example, if you're using an application and you think that this is a great application, but, you know, I think I'd like it better if it did this, you submit that on the forums online, and it's very likely the developer is going to either agree with you or give you the options to work around that and get that solution taken care of. We've had several opportunities in our district to actually engage the community on software situations. I'll give you an example. Once we had, when we deployed our servers, the first day back was the day after Windows XP Service Pack 2 was released. Okay, and we deployed a bunch of Linux servers. Problem was, is we had this process laid out. We moved from NetWare to Linux, so we had this process laid out where everyone was going to have to change their password. We had to reset everybody's password to a standard one because we were using a different authentication system. So we set everybody's password to standard, and we printed all these directions. We wanted to be as seamless as possible, gave them to everybody, and said, okay, this is how you change your password. Press Control-Alt-Delete, click on the Change Password button, and change your password. No problem. Everybody gets it, right? So the day before school gets back in, or day before everybody starts coming back to the office, Windows XP Service Pack 2 comes out, and it broke that. You'd press Control-Alt-Delete, you change your password, and say, I'm sorry, an error occurred. Oh, man, that stinks. You know, this had to be seamless, right? I mean, this had to work. So what we did was we got on the forums where the Samba server, which is the server that we use for this, it basically makes a Linux server look like a Windows server. We got on the forums and said, hey, we're having this big problem. I kid you not, 2 hours later, I had a patch from the developer that fixed it. So our people didn't even know it happened. Okay, you see this kind of stuff happening all over the open source world, and it's a tremendous, tremendous resource. All right, so that's open source software. Any questions about that? All right. Last one is open content. This is creative work that's published in a format that explicitly allows copying and reuse. Essentially, this is sites like Kariki, Wikipedia, even some Flickr you'll see. basically the notion of this is that you're not restricting your users to copyright. Okay, one of the things that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act did is anytime you create anything, the moment you lift your pen from the paper, per se, it's copyrighted and completely protected and nobody can touch it. Right? That's nice, I suppose, unless you actually mean or intend to share that. Right? I mean, we're in a sharing environment. We like to share our content. We like to work and build and those sorts of things. So what the open content does is essentially it provides a way for you to post content online and explicitly define how you intend for that to be used. And you do that through licensing. So basically the notion is this is a some rights reserved technology rather than an all rights reserved technology. The most widely known license for this is the Creative Commons license. How many of you heard of Creative Commons? That's great. You definitely should check out Creative Commons if you haven't. It's creativecommons.org. Okay? Your teachers need to know about this just as much as your students need to know about this. These days, we're all creating piles and piles and piles of content. I mean, huge amounts of content, and we're not thinking about how we want that to be used. And the worst thing that can happen is when a teacher gets really excited about something, they build some great content, and they post it online without thinking about this stuff, and someone uses it in a way that they didn't intend or doesn't give them credit for it. If they know about Creative Commons, you can go straight to their site. There's a nice little quiz on there that allows you to say, I'd like my thing to be used for this, this, and this, and it will give you a little license tag that will tell everybody, it'll tell the world, what's okay and what's not okay with your content. Very important. Open content, I think, is going to really drive education as we move forward. We're already seeing content repositories being built all over the nation. NYLearns is a very well-known one. The state of California is working on one called Brokers of Expertise, which is a project I'm working on. The notion being that teachers will be able to create a repository of resources and lesson plans and content that can be shared across the state that's standards aligned and is useful in the classroom. All right, so that's basically what open technologies are about. Why should we use these in education? Obviously, reduce costs. And if you don't have to think about the cost factor when you're deploying a technology, it completely changes the game. Right? You can actually pull this thing down and try it. Give it a try, see if it works. If it doesn't work, throw it away, get another one. I mean, it's a totally different model. You're not restricted by it. Quality. We were actually quite surprised at Open Technologies, and we've been doing this since about 2004. The quality of open source software generally is better. We found that it's significantly better. There are studies done by the Department of Homeland Security on open source software that finds it's about 100 times less buggy than commercial code. Right? And part of the reason for that is because it is so public, because you can see the source code. So the developers are really worried about making it good because they know they're going to get flamed if they don't. Right? So you get really good quality code. We've been impressed by that. Flexibility is a big factor. If you have a lot of options at your disposal, you have a lot of flexibility. You can put the pieces together that make your classroom fit. Okay? Performance is another factor. Generally, the size of open source applications is significantly smaller because of that same reason. The developers are developing software, and if they write really bad code, everybody flames them and fixes it for them. So the performance generally runs quite a bit better. I can tell you with confidence that our SOM servers, which are serving our Windows workstations, run easily 10 times faster than a Windows server, easily, at copying files. And there's plenty of studies out on the independent studies on the internet to prove that point. Reliability is a big factor. Obviously, you have fewer bugs, you have more reliable systems, so that's important. Security. I don't think I have to even talk about that one very much. I see several Macintoshes in the room, so we have some people who are enlightened in that area. There are 400,000 viruses known now for Windows. When's the last time you heard a major news article about a breach in the Linux system? Ever? I haven't. Right? In fact, a lot of folks say, when I bring up that bullet point, a lot of folks say, oh, Vista's so much better. Computer Reseller News did a study, Windows Vista versus XP, and basically the title of the article was XP Vista Equally at Peril. Both machines were able to be exploited exactly the same ways and exactly as much. It didn't really make any difference at all. Okay? So definitely more secure. Why does all of this matter? This is the most important part, obviously. It gives us flexibility and choice, right? You have choice in the classroom and how you want to deliver technology, how you want to deliver content, how you want to create that learning environment, and you have flexibility because you have a lot of choices to choose from. You have a lot of choices in context, web-based applications versus desktop applications, lots of flexibility there. Interoperability is important. Those open standards I talked about at the beginning allow you to really connect these things together so you're not recreating the wheel every time you create an application. For example, authentication, right? We all have 50 different applications, and generally they have 50 different logins for every kid. You've got Reading Counts has its own login system, and you've got Accelerator Reader has its own login system, and you're duplicating all of this work. If you're using open standards to connect those applications, you don't have to duplicate all that work anymore. All of the authentication is connected. Right? Community influence, if not community driven, this is the way we work. This just makes sense for us in the educational environment. We get together in groups. We solve problems together. We work through things as a community. Reduced IT cost is significant. I can tell you that at our district alone, we save just on the server side of things $50,000 a year in license fees. Right? I talked to our principals just a week ago or so and asked them, hey, did you guys happen to notice that we stopped sending you a bill for software? And they're like, yeah, you know, we noticed that. That's great. We didn't charge them $5,000 a month or a year for software. Yes, sir.
I came from a community college district to a charter school, and at the community college it was, you know, Oracle, PeopleSoft, and millions. And the staff you needed to support that were very high paid as well, because we had to have special skill sets. But what we're finding, we actually have developed our own student information system and open source, but we can't get programmers. We can't hire them because, you know, that have the skills that we need. Because do you experience that, getting the programming staff to, certainly all these things are out there, but how do you integrate them all in a way that have the people that have that skill set to do that? It seems like the Microsoft programmers are just different breed than the open source programmers, and it's really hard for us to hire those people.
Yeah, the tide is changing on that, though. There's a survey done recently by a company that specifically supports programmers, and they've seen a huge rise in open source programming. So that the tide is definitely changing there. But if you think about it this way, think about it from the perspective of the money that you're saving by going with the open source. Rather than taking that money right off the bottom line, why not invest that in developing programmers on the staff and getting training and those sorts of things for them?
That's the hard part. They save that money,
and they pull it right off. Right. And so that has to do with planning up front, and that's something that I would recommend. If any of you start looking at open source, one of the first things you're going to want to do is say, okay, look it. We're going to do this open source initiative. It's going to save us a bunch of money. But we're going to take those dollars, and we're going to invest them in the following, and line that up front. We're going to invest that in programming training. We're going to invest this in staff development, whatever. Right now, there's a gentleman up in Michigan, I forget his name at the moment, who's on our Open Technologies panel, who replaced all of the Microsoft Office in his district with Open Office. Okay, every desktop. Microsoft Office, schools, it's still reasonably cheap. It's about $52 a workstation, but $52 a workstation is $52 a workstation. When you've got a lot of them, and especially with the upgrade cycles, it gets expensive. He made a deal with the teachers, and he said, if you'll let me replace all of the Microsoft Office on your workstations, I promise you I will invest that money in staff development for you to make you better in the classroom. What do you think the teacher said? Absolutely. Right? So he took those dollars, invested them in them. The whole teaching staff has suddenly improved, and the whole educational environment has improved. They're integrating technology in greater ways now than they ever had because they had those dollars available for staff development, which was enabled by open source. You see how all this stuff fits together? I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Okay? All right. Last one, standards compliant, no vendor lock-in. I don't know how many of you, we have a few IT directors in here. I don't know how many of you have been involved in dealing with Windows servers and those sorts of things, but you really get locked in. I mean, you're using Windows servers, which means if you want to use the manage your Windows clients, you have to use Windows servers. Same thing with like VMware. If you're using virtualization, you have to use VMware storage agents. You have to use VMware storage systems. You get locked into a vendor, and you get to the point where you're so far down a path, it's really hard to turn the corner. Right? With open source software, you don't have that problem. They're not trying to lock you in. There's no incentive for them to lock you in. Right? All right. So let's talk about what we do at Saugus briefly. This is supposed to be a case study, so I'm going to kind of breeze over the back office stuff because I want to talk about some of the stuff we're doing in the classroom. But we do have almost all of our infrastructure and management on open source. We migrated back in 2004 all of our systems and servers to Linux. We are running some Windows servers. You can't escape them, unfortunately. There are those applications that require a Windows server. What we do is we virtualize them on top of Linux, so we don't actually have any Windows servers. Okay, that saved us, as I said, about $50,000 a year in licensing costs, which we've been able to invest in other technologies. As I mentioned, we are doing virtualization. That's an important part of our classroom initiative, our green computing initiative, because we don't have to buy as many resources. When you think about buying servers for the tech people, the tech director type people's here, when you think about buying a server or putting in a service like Scholastic or Reading Council, you automatically knee-jerk think server. I've got to get another server. So we buy a server to do this. We buy a server to do that. We buy a server for Reading Council. If we're buying Windows Server, we don't want it to run anything but Reading Council because we know if we run more than one thing, it's probably going to crash. So we have our Exchange split into 18 different servers, and we have all of these boxes, and the boxes aren't being utilized well, right? They're only using a few, you know, a few processor cycles. If you can virtualize, you can consolidate those servers all onto one box, have five or six servers running on one piece of hardware, and better utilize your systems. But more importantly, if you do that, you're also being better up for the environment, because we have so much e-waste these days. I mean, we're throwing away these piles of boxes with hazardous chemicals and everything else, loading up our landfills with all of this garbage that we don't need to load it up with. All right. Classroom, what I want to talk about the classroom is desktop applications and web technologies. This is what I want to talk about most today. First thing I want to talk about are desktop applications. We kind of talked about it a little bit when talking about OpenOffice. One of the things that we do is we give all of our teachers the OpenDisk. Are you guys familiar with the OpenDisk? No. Okay. Website, theopendisk.com. Okay. I've got this. This is going to be on my blog, and there's a link to it. I've also got a listing of the applications that are on it. The OpenDisk is a easy-to-use Windows installer for open-source software. Okay. So this disk, and I've got some here. You can take one with you. I made a bunch of copies. This disk has OpenOffice on it. It has Firefox, which everybody uses, I hope. You're all using Firefox, right? We're all enlightened. Yes. All right. It has Firefox, OpenOffice, has a program called the GIMP. How many of you have Photoshop on every machine in your school? I never get any hands when I ask that question. There's a program called the GIMP. It stands for the GNU Image Manipulation Program. Fantastic program. I can guarantee you it does 99% of what Photoshop does. And you can install on every one of your machines because it's free. So now all of your students and all of your teachers can have access to that. How many of you have gone to a website that a teacher created, and they took a picture and they put on that website a 50 billion megapixel picture, and you watched it scroll down like this, really slowly? We've all been there, right? If they had an application like the GIMP on their desktop, they could have scaled that just like that, and they wouldn't have had a problem with it, right? It does, like I said, does 99% of what Photoshop does. So then the argument automatically comes back to, yes, but we're not teaching them the software that they're using in the industry. Skills transfer, right? You're teaching them the skills. Anybody who can use the GIMP can use use Photoshop very quickly, okay? So anyway, what we do is we hand these out to everybody. Like, it has, I think, at least 30 or 40 applications on it, tons of great stuff. Diagramming software, it has a 3D application, it has all kinds of great stuff. We hand those to the teachers, okay? And then we say this: you can give these to your kids. Think about that. Now, how many times has a kid brought work that they did at home in Office 2007 or whatever, and you had Office 2003, and you couldn't open it, right? And you tried to run that really cool wizard installer that says, hey, click here and you'll install the converter, and then it doesn't work because it doesn't work, right? What if your kids at home had the same applications that they have at school? What if on the first day of school you handed every kid an OpenDisk and said, take this home, install it on your computer, then we know we've got the same stuff at home and at school. Suddenly you have none of those problems. And you can feel confident that when you send an assignment home that has to involve technology, that those kids are going to be able to do it. They're going to have what they need. So think about that with desktop applications. Like I said, I have those. And I'm also going to talk about web technologies. We do a lot of web technologies. Most of what you see in Web 2.0 was invented in the open source world. I mean, this is the stuff that's coming out in the commercial market doesn't hold a candle to the stuff that's out there in open source. So I'm going to show you some of that. But first, I want to talk about one of our biggest initiatives that revolves around desktops and virtualization. And this is our Green Computing Initiative. This is something that we've been working on lately. And this kind of evolved out of a lot of our open source use. What we've done over time, or what we discovered, is that we were really using a lot of, or creating a lot of waste. We were using a lot of computers, throwing a lot of computers away every year. I don't know about you folks, but you probably have a junk pile that looks something like this. Right? You're throwing these things away constantly. You know, they just wear out. And the way that the software industry is designed, it's designed to actually generate this kind of obsolescence, right? Because new operating systems come out and their resources requirements are bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, so those older machines can't be used anymore. Now, we've been already reusing a lot of our computers by installing Linux on it, because Linux is very thin and very light, and it runs on these older machines very, very well. Okay? But we didn't know what kind of an impact that was having on the environment until the EPA released an environment calculator. I can't remember what they called it. Environmental impact calculator, something like that. I've got a link that you can get to that allows you to actually figure out what the cost of the environment is. And what we found out, that we're all talking about green computing. We're talking about how to lower our power requirements and lower our heat generation. But you know what? The thing that makes the most impact on the environment is just reusing machines, finding a way to reuse those machines effectively rather than throwing them away. For example, if you reuse one computer, this is just one computer, 30 pounds of hazardous waste you save, 77 pounds of solid waste and materials, 147 pounds or 17.5 gallons of water from being polluted, 32 tons of air from being polluted, 1,333 pounds of CO2 from being emitted, and 7,719 kilowatts of energy. That's what you save by reusing one computer, just one. It's huge. These are huge numbers. This is the equivalent of taking a half a car off the road for its life, or 67% of a household's annual energy usage. It's huge, right? Not only that, but you also get to give more technology to kids, give greater access to technology. All right, so what do? One of the first things we do is we've actually loosened our policy on donations. I don't know about you. You may come from a district that has the closed policy toward donations. You want to donate a computer, forget it. You know, that's basically what they say. And we were kind of that way for quite a while. But now that we found that we can actually implement this effectively, we're now accepting donations. Now, I will say that we're not accepting individual donations. So if mom and dad want to donate a Packard Bell, sorry. We want them to be semi-consistent. So if the company comes at us and they say they wanted to donate five or more, we'll generally accept them. Okay, we accept those five or more computers, and we install Linux on them. These are three of the Linux green computers that we have in one of our classrooms. We actually got 70 of these for one school site and deployed them and increased the access to technology for our students in the classroom. Funny thing is you ask those teachers and those students what those computers are running, they have no idea. They walk up, they have Firefox, right? They have a thing that says word processor, which is OpenOffice. They have all the stuff that they need in the classroom, and it works great, and it gives them greater access to technology in the classroom. All right, so these machines that you're looking at, they're the standard Dell case, which they shipped for like 8 years straight. These are about four and a half years old or so. These are generally our Pentium, some of these are Pentium 3s, some of them are Celerons, you know, older machines. They run, I guarantee you, they run faster than Windows 98 even ran on them for the kids, which is great. They do flash, they do everything the kids need to do. So with those kinds of computers, we put them directly in the classroom and install Linux on them. Now, one of the nice things about Linux, too, is that because it is so open, nothing's hidden, you can actually script the installation process. Everything's all open, readable, and textable, and scriptable, which is a key. So what we did was we created a boot CD that automatically installs these that we hand to teachers. So now what they do is if they have a problem with a computer in their classroom or they have an old Windows 98 machine in their classroom and they want to give up on it, they take that CD and they stick it in the disk drive and they press go. The CD does the entire install and configures the entire thing for us, sends us an email when it's done telling us what the IP address is. We jump on that machine and do the last little step, which is just joining it to the domain so they can log in with their standard login just like they would on a Windows machine, and they're off to the races. So we had 60 machines that we got in 1 week. With the help of some teachers, we deployed them in 2 days. And we did it with all these disks. And the teachers just kind of went, and they could just, it's very easy for the teachers. They stick the CDs in, and they boot up, and they're off and running. Right? So suddenly, this particular school has access to 60 more machines in the classroom. All right. This picture's a little dark. Actually, the projector's a little dark. The next step is the thin client lab. This is actually our green lab, we call it. And what we're doing with this is we're actually taking the really old machines, the machines that are 6 or 8 years old that don't have working hard drives and just the ones that just barely turn on, and we're putting them in a lab and we're booting them off of a server instead. So this is the K-12 Linux LTSP or Linux Terminal Server project. It's designed specifically for K-12. You install it on a server and hook all these machines up to that server, and the machines boot off the server rather than having to boot off an internal hard drive. So essentially all the programs are running on the server and the workstations are just acting like a viewer. Okay, so we've got this lab. This particular lab has 30 machines in it. All of those machines boot off of the server, and they look just like the Linux desktops at our other school, and they run really, really fast. So the people at the school side come up to us and say, "This is the best lab we've ever had. It runs really, really quick." Right? And we have all these, and they don't know. You see, they've got flat panels on them. They know now what they've got. But initially, they didn't realize that these machines were like 6 or 8 years old and didn't even have hard drives in them, right? Because they just worked. Right. So again, more better access to technology.
Set this up
This lab, well, it was the cost of the flat panels was all. The cost of the flat panels and the cost of a server. So we spent, I think we bought, the server we bought was $2,500. The flat panels were about $150 a piece. So we estimate we saved about $12,000 setting this lab up. Yes, sir.
What type of software are you running on those machines? Like, what type of work are the students doing?
The students are doing everything. They're doing, you know, Web 2.0 stuff. They're doing word processing, all the typical stuff. It comes with all the open source applications for drilling and killing in the education environment, like Tux Math and Tux Paint, Tux Typing. There are probably 70 or 80 education applications alone in the education menu there. Now, flashcards, geography, all that stuff.
But can they go to the creative side of video production?
No.
Okay, that's what I'm wondering.
Right.
Where's the limit there?
Yeah, that's where the limit is, and that's the thing. You do have to establish something of a balance, obviously, right? You aren't going to take the Linux workstations that are 4 or 5 years old and put them in a classroom and have kids do video production on them. You want to get the right tool for the task. So in that case, you want to have a balance, and we're in a very open district as far as that goes. We don't tell people what they're going to use on their desktops or anything like that. If they want to use a Mac, they use a Mac. If they want to use a PC, they use a PC. We usually, for video production, recommend a Mac, obviously. So get a few Macs here strategically located. You have to be strategic about it, basically. If you can set up a lab or a workstation or an area where kids have access to more technology, it's obviously a great gain for the school. You know, we have a lot of common areas. The way our schools are designed is the classrooms are designed around a core, generally, which most schools are designed like. In that core, we can put a bunch of these guys, like 6 or 8 of them, and the kids gain better, more access to technology again. So you can send the kids out there to work on a project. They can do Blender 3D. They can do, you know, whatever they need to do, with the exception of things like video production. At any time during the day, they have complete access. So,
does your open disk have all those educational stuff?
It has a lot of them. It doesn't have all of them that are on this, because this is a big old DVD that installs off this, but this has most of them.
But the website would have those as well?
Yeah, if you go to the k12ltsp.org site, you can see what applications are on. Like I said, it's an easy DVD. You don't have to have anything special. You can test it. Remember, this is free. You can try it. Get a machine somewhere, any machine, stick the LTSP on it and install it. And give it a shot. See how it works for you.
Can you repeat that website again?
K12ltsp.org. All right. So that's what we're doing with the Green Computing Initiative. Obviously, this increases student access to technology, reduces our footprint on the environment. That's a biggie. Extends the usable lifetime and saves money. We've saved a tremendous amount of money and given kids better access to technology by using open source. All right. So that's our Green Computing Initiative. There's documentation on my blog. Again, grab my card. You can look at it. I actually have a bunch of wiki pages set up. We have wiki pages set up in our blogs. Imagine that. Wiki's in a social context. I have a wiki assigned to my account with the Green Computing thing that talks about this in great detail, so you can find out exactly what we're doing. All right, so the big one, the other thing I want to talk to you about is open source Web 2.0, the things we use. One of the things we do is a collaboration suite. I'm not going to show you this today. We use a software package called Zimbra. I can guarantee you that this runs circles around Microsoft Exchange or any of those other applications that you have out there for email. It has calendaring. It has everything, thick client-style functionality in a web browser. So what this means is that every time there's a modification or a change to this program, I can install it in one place and everybody gets it. We've updated this application 7 or 8 times now, and nobody even knew it happened except that they got new options. But the really killer thing about this is an open source application, which means the community is involved in making it better. So some of the community things that have come out of that is the addition of things like wiki pages. It's got a document section. Right? So now inside my email package, I've got the typical email calendar address book, but then I've got a documents tab. And if I click on that documents tab, I can actually create wiki pages right inside my email program. But it doesn't stop there, because it's in my email program. I can choose who I want to share those with and who I want to work with me on those. So I can right-click on a page or a notebook, it's called in this thing, and say, share this with these 5 people, and these 4 can edit the pages, and these 5 can see it. Right? That's in my web browser. I've got instant messaging built into my web browser, into my collaboration suite. Very cool. The nice thing about that is those things came out of the community. They weren't things that the company actually developed. This is an open source application, but you can get a free version of it, but the one we're using is one that we pay for support for. The other thing is that you can drive the development of this software. The way that they do that is you actually post what you'd like to see in the software online on their systems, and then the entire community votes on them. And the option that you voted, if your option bubbles up to the top, that's the next thing everybody works on. So when was the last time you had the opportunity to do that with a software package, right? Everybody vote on what we want for the software package rather than what the company wants for the software package, really very cool. I don't have time to show that, but if you want to see it after, I'd be glad to show you. Content management, this is something I probably will show you. One thing that we're doing with our website is our entire website is put on a content management system. What that allows us to do is it allows us to separate out creating the content for the website from the website itself, right? So you can push out the content creation process to the people who are actually creating that content rather than having to have a webmaster generate all that content. Okay? Makes a lot of sense. And there's tons of that going on out there in the commercial world, but there's nothing quite like the open source versions. We're using a program called Drupal, which has something like 2,000 plugins that do everything you can imagine. I mean, we register people for staff development on it and all kinds of other crazy stuff. And remember, I was talking earlier in the presentation about that, about those open standards and how they all link together? Let me show you how that actually works. This is our website. It's driven entirely off of Drupal. One of the things we did with this open source application is we set it up so that you see something different when you're inside the district versus when you're outside the district. So our employees have an internet page, and our external people see just the external page. This is the internet page. And the interesting thing about this is the internet page, none of this content is in the system at all. It pulls all of this content in using open standards. This is pulled, the main news and events is pulled off an RSS feed off of our blog for our news and events. The latest from the SUSD teacher community and student communities, which are our blogging sites for teachers and students, are pulled in via RSS. Right? Open standards again. We pull all this stuff in so it dynamically changes. So you can see my latest post. This is my post with all the content for this session is right at the top of the list. Math Field Day Prep, PAR Workshop. We have a teacher who posted something on copyright Creative Commons and Flickr. It's actually a video tutorial for other teachers. All of this stuff is accessible on our internet site. We also pull in the feed from eSchool News, something that we think might be useful for our teachers and our students. And remember I told you that Zimber has calendaring. It supports iCalendar, so we pull in the master calendar. So this updates every single time someone goes to the website so they can see what's coming up in the district. So that paper calendar that everybody hands you at the beginning of the school year that you might as well just throw away because it's all changed by the time you actually got it, it's not a factor anymore. Right? Our people have access to that. Some other interesting things that we do is we actually, remember I said talked about moving the content creation to the producer. You can see I'm actually logged in. You notice I have an edit button, edit link here. I can just click on this to edit this particular piece of content. That's very easy for an end user to do as well. So our business secretaries, for example, will post content on our main homepage, which is here.
Can you also talk about the SUSD students at work?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that next. So this is our main homepage. As you can see, this also is dynamic content. Announcements. This I didn't put in. Wildfires in Sylmar and Porter Ranch. Right? If you've been watching the news, there's huge wildfires out there. I didn't even know they were happening until I was driving to the airport yesterday, and the freeways were covered with smoke. You couldn't see anything. Someone at our school site, our safety director probably, got in and posted this online on the homepage of our website. Didn't need me to do it. Didn't need any of our tech people to do it. Posted it and is available immediately. Again, the calendar gets pulled up automatically. Right? These are huge gains for school districts trying to communicate with their community. Yes, ma'am.
Who actually manages these things? I mean, if you're paying for a service, then you're paying for them to deal with it. How has that changed your staffing as well?
Well, I can tell you that our staffing hasn't changed. Okay, that hasn't changed at all, but we are managing the system. We are running it on our own servers. Okay, so one of the things we did when we saved all that money going to Linux, we invested that money in our staff for training to get them going in this direction so that they could do these sorts of things and they can manage this sort of stuff.
Who is then training your staff? Are you having to, similar to the question the gentleman over there, are you having to essentially train your own people?
What we do is we send them out. There's plenty of training actually out there on open source. Okay, so generally this revolves around management. This is like managing a Linux server and those sorts of things. You can get training from Red Hat. There's also training from Novell. There's training from there's a Linux Professionals Institute, which does a bunch of training. So we invest in all of that, and we send our people out and get them trained in that. And then we do some internal staff development as well. You know, we have some sharp guys who are, I mean, you know what a tech department is like. It's really geeky anyway. They go to the Google if they want to do something, and they type in, you know, or PHP tutorial or whatever, and try to figure out how PHP works. So a lot of our guys just have self-developed after they've gotten that training. You do need that initial bump to get them going, but once they're going, generally, they go. So we haven't had too much trouble with that.
One other quick question.
Mm-hmm.
How many network guys do you have, or gals?
Network guys or gals? We have 4 total staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's tech support?
That's tech support, break fix, everything.
Does that include you?
That includes me. Now, I can tell you how we did that. That also is an open source story that I wasn't planning on sharing, but I will share. How we did that is, obviously we've seen a significant increase in technology use in our district, right? We've measured this at about 475% in the last 5 years, 4 years, since 2004. Right, no increase in staff. Part of the reason we were able to do that, though, is because we've done things like we've implemented a remote control of our workstations. How many of you do remote control in your district or have ever had a tech take your computer over? You do remote control in your district. Most people don't. There are a lot of districts that don't. And they don't because it costs too much. It's really expensive for a workstation to do. We use open source software to do that with a program called VNC. It's a free program that allows remote control of workstations. Okay, so we installed that on every workstation across the district. It works with Macs, it works with Linux, it works with Windows. So now when someone has a problem, they call us on the phone and they say, hey, I'm having a problem with my software program or whatever, and we jump on their machine and fix it. Right? We did a survey of all of our teachers and they said 60% of them said that their service problems are solved within 24 hours. I don't think I've ever seen a survey of a school district support department that's been that great. You know, we're able to deal with just about everything except for real hardware problems remotely, and we do it with VNC. One thing that we're doing with these little desktops, these little EPCs, is we're going to use a program called iTalk. Anybody ever heard of iTalk? Fantastic program. It's developed by a German guy. The folks in Indiana helped develop it. Okay, and these are the EPCs that we're going to be doing. If you're not familiar with Indiana's project is essentially a one-to-one desktop situation and they're using all Linux all across the state. Okay, it's a really great project. And one of the things that they got involved in as a school district is helping to develop this software package to manage the labs. So there's a lot of Indiana code in there, there's a lot of German code in there, there's lots of all kinds of stuff in there to develop this really cool application called iTalk, which essentially allows you to manage an entire lab of computers. You can put on the screen the screens of all of the computers in the lab all at once and see exactly where they're at. You can throw your screen on all of them. You can throw an individual screen on all of them, so you can have a student demonstrate something. You can do all of that stuff in the lab, and it's all free. We're going to be deploying that in all of these. Okay. But you can lock them too, which the teachers really like. You press the lock button and they get a big lock on the screen and then they have to listen. Yes, sir?
What's the name of that one?
It's iTalk, it's called, like talcum powder, iTalk. Yeah. All right. So that's another open source application that gives us a significantly greater control and it gives our teachers really greater ability in the classroom too, which I think is going to be fantastic for them. All right. So that's how we've done it with the staff. Last thing I want to show you is our student communities. Let me switch back here. All right. So one thing that we've done with students is we've actually created social networking and blogging sites. Okay. Now, a lot of folks say social networking in schools, no, no, no. We can't do that. It's not safe. It's not whatever. My personal opinion on that is if you're not teaching kids to use these things safely, you're just as much responsible for them doing things wrong online. Okay? You need to be actually teaching your kids to use these things. And the only way that you can teach them to use it well is to provide them with the right context to use them in and the opportunities to make those mistakes and have your teachers fix them. Okay? And teach the kids. It's those teachable moments that are the most valuable. So what we've done is we've used open source software again to deploy a social networking platform. We're using a program called ELG. It's ELGG. It was a PhD project for a student at Brighton University in the UK. And it grew and grew and grew. And there's bunches of people involved in the development process on it. So what it gives our kids is blogging and podcasting. It also does wikis in a social context. So you think about, you know, you have your profile on a blogging site and you have your wiki pages attached directly to them. So no longer are you bouncing back and forth between PBWiki and Blogger and all the other stuff all over the place. It's all in one nice, neat little package. File and media sharing and communities. And rather than talk to you a whole lot about that, I thought I'd just show you some of the stuff. So let's see what some of our kids are doing with this. One of the classrooms last year, I'm running this locally because I know what internet access is like, so don't write down the URL or anything. If you go to our website, you can find it. One of our teachers asked an interesting question of their students. They said, why don't you take our classroom and build a dream classroom? Have you ever thought of that? Have you ever thought of actually engaging your kids in designing the best classroom for their environment? So as you can see, they used a website called classroomforteachers.org, which allows you to essentially say, my room is this big, and here's all this stuff that I want to put in the room, and all the kids get to design their own room. So all the kids got online, and they designed their ideal classroom. It's fantastic. The kids get the opportunity to have a stake in how the classroom is set up. They get to explain exactly why they designed their classroom that way, and most importantly, other kids get to comment on them. Right, so you can look at the comments on this one. I think you did a great job. The only thing I'd recommend is that you make things a little less crowded. So the kids actually are engaging in community. They're actually working together on these projects, right? The teacher gets in, it's great, like a fusion between a school and Starbucks. If you can get the district to embrace smaller class sizes in the upper grades, your design will be implemented immediately. Right? That's very inspirational for the kids. Let me show you another one. This is a second grader. A lot of folks think that little kids can't do this, right? You have to be third or fourth grade. This is a second grader recorded a podcast. He's reading Dragon Gets By. Let me play it for you really quick.
This story is called Dragon Gets By. It is by Dave Piggy. Shopping. Dragon looked in his cupboard, but there was no food at all. The cupboard is bare.
Now, he's very expressive, but the interesting thing about this is that he did it multiple times because the audience was much more authentic than just teacher-student. He was preparing something not only for his classmates, but for other students in the district and for people in public, and I think public is very important. These things need to be public. Mom and dad need to have access to it. Grandma and grandpa in Indiana need to have access to it. These are huge motivators for kids. If you look at the bottom here, some of the comments, what a fabulous reader you are, Mark. Are you sure you're only 8 years old? Love, Auntie Gail. That has a big impact on a kid's motivation. And like I said, he went through multiple takes on this. When's the last time you had a student go back and redo something multiple times to get it right?
Keep people from being malicious here.
Well, that's the cool thing. This is open source. So what we did, one of the nice things about this application, is it allows you to apply access controls to everything. Okay, so when you're as a teacher, you have full rights to the system. You can make anything public, private, whatever. As a student, when you post stuff, it posts by default in private. The teacher has to review it and make it public if they want to make it public. Okay, we do send home a permission form. We've thought this whole thing out. Send home a permission form. We have adjusted our acceptable use policy, all that kind of stuff for parents to let them know what's going on and all of those sorts of things. We teach our teachers what the responsibilities are, what the issues could be, all of those sorts of things before they get started on this, so that we all have a nice, cohesive, clean environment and everything works really well. Okay? All right, so that's Mark. And we interviewed Mark just to see what he thought of all of this stuff and listen to what he said. I think it's fantastic.
You know what I like about making a podcast? It was that I had so much expression. I'm not trying to brag, but yeah, I had that. And I liked hearing my voice. I'm not trying to brag, but yeah. And, that's pretty much it.
Right? Great kid. I think he's motivated to do some more reading and some more writing and working on the blogs and things like that. I think he probably is. This is another great one, a great example. This is our sixth grade class. In this particular situation, not our only sixth grade class, we have lots of them, but this is a sixth grade class. And one of the things that happened with this particular class is one of the students was out in the hospital for an extended period of time. Okay, they couldn't come to school for some time. And the kids in the class decided that they wanted to make a video for that kid. So essentially, this is a self-assignment. The kids actually self-assigned themselves work. And they set up a video for this kid to tell him what's going on in school. They had to decide who's going to be the talent, who's going to be the writer, who's going to do the video shooting, all of that stuff on their own, and they put that all together and built a little video. Let me play that for you really quick. It takes a second to load because it's so big. Theoretically. There it goes.
Things are so boring without Diane.
Yeah, I sure do miss her. I wish she was here.
Oh my gosh! Oh Diane, oh my gosh. There's so much for me to tell you. I mean, like the school and the new NPR and the... Oh my gosh.
Okay, well, Diane...
Okay, so they connected with that kid. Now, if you read the comments on here, this is important. You got comments from other teachers and things here that saw this, right? Gianna, a friend, said, the movie was awesome and I love the bloopers part. Diane, I can't wait till you get back to school. Right? They actually connected to this kid outside of school and let them know that they were missed and made them want to come back. And I think that's great. Let me show you another one. One of the things that we talk about a lot is... student-created lessons. One of the interesting things is students have a tendency to learn a lot better from other students. Have you noticed that? Now, if other students get the opportunity to teach other students, or if a student gets the opportunity to teach another student, not only do they learn it better, but the person who's learning it learns it better. And a lot of folks say, how do you do math with technology? That's one of the hard things. We have one of our classes that does something called the Math Minute. This is a podcast that they record. I think they record it weekly. And they get together in teams of two to build this thing. Got a little pre-roll. It's nice.
Hi, Peter Madeline H. I'm having a little trouble with adding and subtracting fractions. Do you think you would help me?
Didn't you pay attention in math class? So are you going to help me?
Right. Another example. Let's see, geometry. This is an this is one that you'll see where the access control is controlled. This particular one is not available to the public. These two kids got together on their own and decided to build a geometry 101 slideshow in PowerPoint and post it online. So you go through this slideshow and it talks about the table of contents. And you look at the table of contents, it's pretty staggering. They cover all of these things, what they are, with visual aids. Really pretty neat. And they decided to do this completely on their own. Now, the reason it's not public is because one of the kids says, wow, you guys did an awesome job. You guys really took your time and it shows. One of the teachers talked about it and said, your slide that says radius is, they had a mistake in it, that's why. So they haven't got it fixed, and that's why it hasn't been posted public yet. So there's a mistake in the slide. But you get the gist. Other kids get to see this and learn from it. Okay? How about just-in-time learning? This was a fantastic example I really like. So this is one of our teachers. His name is David Lindsay, and he does lots of really cool stuff with this. One of the students asked a question in his web blog. Oops. Local server. All right, let's go back. There we go. He said, I need help with math we're doing right now in unit conversions. Please help me if you'll write back. Okay? Teacher sees this on a weekend, right? And he makes this.
This is the first lesson I've done involving a window marker, a window, a beach towel, and quick time. So hopefully this will work out.
Right? So a teacher connects directly with the kid in a really digital 21st century way that the kid really can attach to. Arlene Anderson is another teacher, said that it was fantastic. And a couple of kids said, thanks, Mr. Lindy, I made notes on this video. It helped. Other kids connecting to this stuff and learning from it. Another student, thanks, Mr. Lindy, I understand a little bit more now. Right? You can see that this one isn't visible yet. Teacher has the ability to make the comments visible. It's all completely controlled. Okay? And that stuff's all really exciting and all, but the stuff that really... That really gets to me is the connectedness of all of this. Okay, it's interesting when kids are doing individual projects, and that's great. But when they start to connect to each other, that's when it really starts to matter. So let me show you this self assignment. This is a fantastic one. This was done by a Gate student. We have a Summer Gate Institute. This is summertime. The students self assigned themselves writing an article about Albert Einstein. It's a fairly long article. You can see he embedded Albert Einstein quotes. But the interesting thing to me about this is it says, "Thank you, Mrs. Bixler, for your post on Barack Obama. It gave me the idea for writing this." Now, who's Mrs. Bixler? Well, let's go. Mrs. Bixler wrote a post on Barack Obama, a story by Roberta Edwards. She did this as a model for her second grade class, who was involved in their summer reading challenge, who was using the blogging site for the summer reading challenge. So what she did was she gave all of her second graders a blogging account. Every second grader had to report what books they were reading in the summer reading challenge on the blog. And she was modeling it here. So you have a sixth grader connected to something that a teacher did and decided to do some learning and some work on their own. I think that's fantastic. Ms. Bixler also connected to someone else. This was an interesting one. She says on her page, Mr. Lindsay's April 25th post, Mr. Lindsay was the other teacher I showed you before. She saw his work and says, dear second graders in Mrs. Bixler's class, look at the photo on Mr. Lindsay's post and comment what you think this creature might be, and so on and so forth. You can see all the kids got in and commented what they thought it might be. All right, it's another learning opportunity. If you look at the 25th post, it's actually pretty cool. He gets these funny pictures of this, like that. And says, comment on what this creature's habitat is, all these kinds of things with his sixth graders. But you actually see this connection. It's no longer even grade level specific anymore. You got six second graders and sixth graders and everybody connecting, right? And I saved my favorite demo for last, and this is Corey. Corey is a great kid. He decided on his own, again, this is another self-assignment, to write a book. He's basically writing a book called Despite Enemies, and it's on World War II. And as you can see, he's got 9 chapters here. If you actually go to our website, this is a local copy it's a little old. He's written up to 12 chapters. He's writing his own book. And the book is interesting, but you know, that part of it I think is unremarkable. The remarkable part about it is the comments that he got on it. So he writes his first chapter, right? And you'll notice that his command of World War II is fantastic for a sixth grader. But you look at the comments on the bottom of this, and you see the typical stuff. This is a great, exciting story. I can't wait to hear the next chapter or read the next chapter. That's his teacher. A guest said, I could sense the heart pounding, the fear that Johnny Willow must have felt. I'm looking forward to the next chapter. This one is the one that gets me. Your words have painted a very vivid picture. You did an excellent job of illustrating the terror of war. Keep up the good work, an Army colonel. Right? Now, how can you motivate a kid better than that? I have a feeling that he wrote the rest of those chapters in large part because of the great response he got to this. Right? Now, I have a secret about Corey that I haven't told you yet. And that secret is that Corey is a resource kid. He's a special ed kid. Okay? He's challenged in every way academically. But he's found a place where he can say, this is me, and this is what I can do. This is my talent. I have value. So if you go to visit this kid today, he's actually out of our school system. He's into the next one. But if you were to visit him last year, at the end of the year, he was like a celebrity. He suddenly had friends. All the kids knew about his story, right? It's completely changed this kid, and it's really put him on the right path, I think. So this Web 2.0 stuff is big. It's important. And giving kids the ability to do it using open source software can have a significant impact in your school. All right, so I'm sorry, I'm a little bit over time. Let me wrap up really quick. All right, so that's what we're doing with open source, with Web 2.0. I'll skip that one. This one's actually pretty funny. Good news is they're hyper-connected. The bad news is that that's all they are. Right? What we've basically done here is we've given them context. We've given them a space that makes sense, where they're really connecting for something of value. Okay? So basically what we try to do is we try to change school from this and this to this. You've got kids connecting to teachers, teachers connecting to other teachers, classrooms connecting to other classrooms. The connections are taking place. The kids are growing and learning in groups. Right? We're basically giving the world access to our kids and our kids access to the world. All right. So, all this talk about open source and social networking and all that kind of stuff, what's the real impact here? How does this change the game? Socially, it changes relationships between producers and consumers. In the traditional sense, we've all been used to being the receivers of things. There's been one person who has the knowledge, and we are the receivers of it, and there's just one delivery mechanism. Suddenly, we have the opportunity to actually be engaged in the process. Changes the way we view software. Software to support processes rather than processes to support software. This is important. When you try to put in applications at school districts, we often change our processes to fit the software that we bought. That doesn't make sense. If you have access to a wide range of software, you can choose what you want to do and then find the software that matches that. Creates a culture of open collaboration, people willing to share. I didn't even show you the teacher side of this. We created two separate communities. We have a teacher community where, as you saw, the Creative Commons thing, talking about Creative Commons and Flickr. That was one teacher. Did a little video podcast that he's doing. It's called Tech Bytes, sharing with all the other teachers information that they need to know to use in their classroom. Creates really great culture there. And unintended consequences. I'll give you one example of that. By using Audacity, which is an open source program for recording, we had a bunch of students in a classroom actually sitting in front of a computer recording a podcast, and a speech teacher walked in the classroom and looked over their shoulder and says, "What's that you're doing?" And they said, "We're recording a podcast." And she looked and she saw that the Audacity does these waveforms on the screen, which is really cool. And she said, "You know what, I could use that in my speech training for kids." So she takes that application back, and now she uses it with all of her kids. And what she does is she gets in the system, and she records herself saying something properly, and then says, "Kids, match that waveform, and keep trying until you do." The waveform is the same, even if the voices are different, so the kids can practice and practice and practice as much as they need to, and get better at speech. And it's kind of an unintended, you know, side thing that they saw because we had access to the software because the software is being used in the classroom. And suddenly this software is being used for more than just recording now. It's being used for teaching. Another example, we had teachers see that and say, this is fantastic for reading fluency, right? You do these reading fluency things and the kids are always, you have to do this one-on-one thing where you sit with a kid and they read to you and it takes a lot of time. Why not send the kids all over their own computer and have them record it and stick it on the server and listen to it later? It's an interesting idea, and it's something that was enabled by open source. Technical, it enables new technology use. Obviously, you have access to more software, you can use more software, you can use more technology. We also enables new technology in the classroom with more computers. Improved functionality through flexibility. I think I've talked about that to death, I think. You have more access to software. Greater reliability creates more time for IT innovation. I was asked, how do we do it with four, basically? We don't have reliability problems. I'm not rebooting servers all the time. I've got servers that have been running for 600 days and have not been rebooted once, because I don't have to deal with all of that stuff, right? And educational enables and boosts innovation, obviously facilitates pedagogic diversity and choice. Wouldn't it be nice if when you're trying to build a reading lesson, you could either choose between using a web-based thing or you could use a desktop thing, or you could look at all the options that are out there and have a lot of things at your disposal, a buffet of options. Offers diversity in both context and provision. All right. And so my last slides, learning landscape of the future. In my opinion, this is the way I see things going, and it's all enabled by this. Students and teachers using technology to create and share content in a collaborative way. Students and teachers. Refocuses the emphasis of technology on teaching and learning. For goodness sake, let's stop teaching technology. Technology should not be a subject. Okay? Use the right tools. Teach kids to learn using technology. Classroom-driven integration of content learning resources. Classroom-driven. Have the classroom, have the teachers creating the content and sharing it. And new ways of learning. Obviously, the literacy of information navigation, project-based learning. There's tons of project opportunities. I showed you just a few. We have people doing science podcasts and groups and all kinds of other kinds of crazy stuff that you can do really easily. It's really simple. It's not the kind of thing that teachers would be put off by or afraid of because it is so easy to do. And construction of creation through a diverse range of available resources and tools. So, this is kind of how we see a drawing of it, and this kind of puts it all together, I think, really nicely. You have the public at the top. You have your external applications, your Flickr, your Delicious, all that sort of thing. ELG is our social networking platform. You notice all of these arrows in here. These all tie everything together with open standards. Open source, Moodle servers, open source, your online libraries. Students are over here, and it's all tied together to your central systems, your student records, your LDAP directories, all of that kind of stuff. So it's all a cohesive ecosystem. Everything works together. Everything works the way it should. And with that, I'm finished. A little late. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I've got cards up here that you can grab. I've got open CDs. Grab as many copies as you like. Remember that you can go online and you can copy them yourself. You can make as many as you want. All right? And if you'd like to play with the EPC, you're welcome to too. All right, thank you very much.